Welcome to the Terminal Value Podcast, where each episode provides in-depth insights about the long-term value of companies and ideas in our current world. Your host for this podcast is Doug Utberg, the founder and principal consultant for Business of Life, LLC.
Welcome to the Terminal Value Podcast. I have Joe Valley with us today, and what we're going to be talking about is selling an online business. Specifically, we're going to be talking about what is it about selling an online business that is unique and or different from selling a traditional business? Joe, please introduce yourself and don't let me talk too much.
Okay, I'll try my best, Doug, and you don't let me talk too much either. I have a tendency to ramble. I've been self-employed since 1997. I built and sold my last e-commerce business, my own personal last e-commerce business in 2010. And I sold it through a company called Quiet Light, or Quiet Light Brokerage, it was called at the time. And it's an online firm that specializes in online transactions only, and only represents the sell side. After taking about a year off, Doug, I went to work for the firm. And it was small at the time. There's only four of us. Now we've got about 30 or so folks, 14 of them advisors, and the original founder and myself are partners. So for the last decade or so, I've been acting as an M&A advisor in the online space only. I've personally sold about 100 million in total transactions, and through the team touched another, I want to say 600 million, a little over a half a billion in transactions. And it's a different world today than it was back in 2012. Back then, the average transaction size was maybe $100,000, $150,000. Today, median transaction size year to date is about $2 million for us. Okay. Anyway, so different world than it was a decade ago, that's for sure.
Well, and is that just a function of higher valuations? Is that higher revenue? Are there more profits? Kind of what do you think is driving that? Because, one of the things that I was sort of thinking is, you know, when you're dealing with that, you know, say if you talk to a traditional business broker, what they'll do is they'll look at usually some kind of ratio of either revenue, earnings, cash flow, or some combination of the two. And then there'll usually be some kind of implied, there may or may not be an implied growth rate built in, depending on whether, you know, if you're talking something brick and mortar, you might have like a brick and mortar, you might have a low single digit implied growth rate built in for your valuation. I mean, and typically you would do some kind of discounted cash flow for figuring out, you know, how you'd want to value something like this. But if you're talking online, I would imagine it's a little, the dynamics are different. What have you seen in that?
Yeah, it's a little different. These types of business are very asset light. Generally, yes. There's almost nothing, right? Because everything lives online. Even, you know, we've got folks that are doing $10, $20, $30 million in revenue. And still, it's with a small group of VAs and an owner or two, generally working remotely from each other.
Yeah.
You know, I just told you that, you know, we've got a total of 30 people, including the advisors, yet no one has an office. We don't meet. Everything is done online. We're spread all over the country and all over the world. So the assets for these types of businesses are very light. In terms, the purchase agreements are generally 80% goodwill, 20% assets, whereas brick and mortar, it's just the opposite. There's a lot of assets. The real estate often comes into play, or the value of the lease if it's a really high rent retail area. And it's very different than what we do.
Well, and I would imagine that, you know, and so, you know, I'll let you keep going, but it would seem to me that, you know, if you have a very light asset base, but you can generate, you know, significant revenue, especially if you can generate significant growth, I would imagine that that would result in a very high multiple, because basically in theory, what that would mean is that if you can just replicate those growth factors, that you can essentially grow unbounded. You know, because I think, you know, this is the value proposition for like a lot of software as a service companies, is that, you know, if you're really just leasing web space from somebody like AWS or Azure, and you can essentially, you know, and when you lease that and then you package your service on top of it, if you, you know, if you're generating a net profit margin, there's really no limit to how fast or far you can grow.
Yeah, and it's very different than a retail brick and mortar store where your growth is limited to the population around you, right? In the online space, the growth has in many ways unlimited potential. And you are right, you used the word multiple. So the value of the online world businesses, for the most part, is a multiple of what's called seller's discretionary earnings, or SDE. Okay. It's your net income plus the add backs, which are generally personal owner benefits and one-time expenses that don't carry forward. And because of the age of the internet, Doug, the multiples of these types of businesses, were fairly depressed up until, I would say, 2 years ago.
When, what do you think that is?
Well, it's very specific to what's called an aggregator. These are the folks like Thrasio, Perch, Boosted, Elevated. There's a group of they're probably 75 to 100 altogether, but a small group of them, you know, the top five have raised, you know, well over $3 billion to buy online businesses, but very specific online businesses. Mm-hmm. They would be Amazon, fulfilled by Amazon, or FBA businesses.
Yeah.
And so they're buying them at a low multiple, bringing them into their portfolio, and immediately get a boost in value because their portfolio does more revenue and more discretionary earnings and is less risk, therefore lower risk, higher value. And it's really done in the last 2 or 3 years what a company like QuietLight, that's been around for 14, has been unable to do, which is let the world know that an online business is a real business and has real value. So the multiples, you know, have started to rise significantly for online businesses compared to even just 3 years ago.
That's interesting. Well, and I was the contrarian part of me says that, you know, anytime you see multiples start accelerating rapidly, that means there's probably a correction coming. But you know, this, you know, but of course, you know, this is also coming through. I was coming out of college and entering the adult workforce right during the tech wreck, after, you know, in the early 2000s. And then then of course I hit the 2008 financial crisis, right when I was starting to feel like I my life's financial situation was getting in a pretty good shape. And, you know, so now of course, that's shaped my perception of the world. And, you know, I just always feel like there's another, you know, cataclysmic crash coming.
Yeah, you get some battle scars. Yeah. And you're never going to forget them. You're always going to think that's possible. And just in the real estate market today, you know, you got to think, my goodness.
Well, and I guess that's the thing. I just keep thinking of something. I go, okay, that it is not humanly possible to continue growing at this rate, that people can't pay those mortgages. Right now, they're just ridiculously cheap because of the low interest rates. But it's like, you know, I just feel like you can't keep growing from the current base. Maybe I'm wrong. I have been a lot of times.
Haven't we all? Haven't we all? That's part of age and wisdom, right? Being wrong a fair amount of time. You know, in this world, in the online world, growth is generally a lot more rapid than the brick and mortar space.
Yeah.
Simply because it's the businesses are newer. They're not as established. And that in itself depressed multiples, along with, you know, the history of online businesses, which is, you know, a couple of decades old at best.
Yeah.
I launched my first online business, I think in 1998, and the website was $50, and it only worked because I had a radio and television campaign associated with it. It's very different today. You know, but something with as low as 25%, and I say that in all seriousness, as low as 25% year over year growth, you know, investors are looking at it saying, okay, well, we can do a lot more because we didn't bootstrap this business. We're coming in with a whole lot of money to make sure we never run out of inventory. We can expand SKUs. We can expand marketplaces. So that 25% is probably going to grow pretty dramatically. Yeah. And even if they pay a 4x multiple on something that's growing 25% year over year and stays that way, they're going to earn their money back in 2.7 years. It's a hell of a return on investment.
Yeah.
What we're seeing with a lot of the aggregators that are buying online businesses, private equity firms, even individuals, is that they come into it with renewed energy and more cash and can grow the business at a much higher rate than 25%.
That makes sense. I mean, just because, like one of the things I've seen, you know, from, you know, as far as like, say, you know, if you're a venture funded business, which again, people think that everything has to be a venture funded business and it doesn't. But if you're, you know, the kind of the template for a venture funded business is that is basically right. You know, your kind of your seed round and your first round are basically getting you to where you have a viable product or service that you can sell profitably. But then in order to keep going, typically you need to be able to show, you know, show a multiple year revenue growth rate of 100% or higher. And so, you know, so my guess is that the way the valuation algorithms probably go is they're assuming that if you buy at about a 25% valuation, there's really no reason it can't be 50, 100 or even 200%, at least for a few years, because, you know, if you're operating off a fairly small base, and so then if you apply online direct marketing best practices, you juice the growth rate up, you can recover your investment in a fairly short amount of time and then be looking at pure upside, or at least that's the way that I'd be evaluating if I was in their shoes.
Yeah, it's exactly the case. A company called Thrasio, Thrasio, uh-huh. Actually S.io, they own 200 brands now in the FBA space, but their valuation is well over $1 billion. They've got a few hundred employees now that manage the brands and have the tools and resources that those individual owner operators never had at their disposal.
Yeah.
And we've sold, Quietlight's sold them probably, of those 200, we've sold them at least maybe 10% of them, right? So 20 brands. Okay. And of the ones that we've been able to stay in touch with, those revenues are growing by 50 to 100% in the first year.
Yeah. 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 That's outstanding. That's excellent. Well, if somebody's listening to this, what can or should they take away from this? Is our call to action here to say, hey, now is a great time to go out, get your FBA business off the ground so you can cash out in a sale down the road?
Any kind of online business, you know, when I started mine, I had no idea that I could sell it, right? It was just me wanting to be an entrepreneur and being off and on my own. And eventually I woke up and decided to sell, which was a mistake. You know, you want to know that you're building a business to eventually exit, and you'd be fantasizing if you think you're going to hold it forever, because you're going to die. Yeah. You're going to pass it on to your kids. You're going to get divorced. Yeah. At least half you are. You got to take all that into account. And as entrepreneurs, we get, you know, shiny object syndrome. We look around, we want to move on to our next adventure. We can't do anything for more than, in my case, you know, 7 years, right? I've been with Quietlight now for a decade, but my role has changed. That's the key thing. If somebody's operating a brand online, they need to either continually expand that brand, create new roles for themselves within the company, or possibly exit. And the best time to think about exiting is long before you're going to do it. I'm not a believer in, you know, start thinking about your exit on the day that you start your business for the first time entrepreneur, right? Really all they need to focus on is keeping the wheels on the bus and making sure that they, you know, get profitable and grow the business.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Once the first step is to make a business that somebody might want to own before you think about selling it.
Exactly. And then, you know, really what I want them to do based upon, you know, my own personal experience, I've built, bought or sold over a half dozen companies of my own, 100 million in transactions for other folks, half a billion that I've touched. And I'd say that 80% of the people that I talk to don't have goals. They don't set exit goals. And if they do that, you know, it's vague and it's, yeah, I'll get to that someday. And then they wake up and someday is here and it's too late to make the little shifts and maneuvers in the business and adjustments in the business to truly get maximum value and make sure you're selling to a great buyer for a great price and great terms too, because they're not all cash.
What are some of those, what are some of those tweaks or hacks that you've seen that are really important to help online people who are, say, starting an online business? Say you're bootstrapping something around it. Say you have a blog that's gotten a following and you're trying to put some kind of information product back in together. What are some, you know, that's just a hypothetical example. You could take it whatever direction you want. But from what you've seen, if somebody's starting an online business, say as a side hustle or something like that, what are some of the things they should really keep in mind in order to make sure that when the time comes for them to sell it, that they're able to do so either with the least amount of effort or getting the most amount of value or both?
Well, there's a lot of things they could and should be doing, and that's part of the challenge. But first and foremost, they should, you know, get an understanding of how valuations work. And that's starting with the math, right? The math is probably 10 to 15% of the whole equation. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, calculating seller's discretionary earnings first. Most people don't properly calculate it. Yeah. They get lost in the numbers and they don't do a proper add back schedule. So they lose tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in the sale of their business if they do it on their own. The second thing is looking at what buyers want. And again and again and again and again, buyers consistently look at risk, growth, transferability, and documentation. Risk is the age of the business, the channels, right? An Amazon only business is a single channel. It's more risk than a business that's 50% Amazon, 50% Shopify. I'd rather buy that second one because the risk is more diverse and I own the customer and I'll pay a higher multiple for it. Yeah. A hero SKU business is a bit of a challenge. It's a single SKU that's representing more than 50% of the revenues of the company. And that could be a blog as well with a couple of hero articles or a SaaS company with a couple of hero clients that has, you know, 200 subscribers in their organization. If that organization goes away, then you lose 50% of your clients. So hero SKUs. Growth is really important. These businesses are young. They should be growing, but there should be built-in paths to growth when you're ready to exit. Meaning, Doug, I'm going to sell you my business and I've got all sorts of ideas that you have to implement. Good luck. No, that's not really going to help me get you to pay maximum value for you to trust me. So I'm going to launch some SKUs 12 months, within 12 months prior to selling my business. So you've got some built-in paths to growth. Gotcha. And all I have to do is jump on that path. I've already cleared it with a machete and you just have to continue to go down that path. And as you learn the business, the transferability should be obvious, but it should go without saying if the assets of the business generate revenue, don't transfer, then you do not have a sellable business. The biggest transfer issue is often the owner of the business. Yeah. If they're the name and face of the business, it's not sell and move on. It's sell and stick around for a while. You know, you're not in the grind every day, but you're at least going to be the name and the face. Then surprisingly, maybe shockingly, the documentation aspect, at least 50% of the people over the last decade that I've talked to don't have proper financials. They don't use QuickBooks. They don't use Xero. They don't know what accrual accounting is. And it's just simply wrong. And it needs to be worked on a lot more. I was guilty of that when I launched my first business. I don't love accounting. I didn't like it then. I get it now. It's important. It's critical. And not reviewing your financials every month, not financials that you produce, but that your bookkeeper, an outsourced bookkeeper that's an expert produces, not your CPA, by the way, but a bookkeeper. CPA does tax mitigation. A bookkeeper will make sure your numbers are right so you can read them properly and your CPA can file your taxes properly. You got to analyze your books every month so that you can make the pivots and changes and see what little levers you need to pull to make sure you get max value when you sell. Yeah.
Well, and a little bit of a cross connection that I was thinking of. And so like, for example, you know, I have a number of people in my network who are in, say, like, for example, multifamily real estate. And one of the oldest tricks in the book is, say, somebody tries to sell an apartment complex, well, and single family real estate too, same difference. But say somebody tries to sell an apartment complex and says, oh, hey, you know, the rents are all 20% under market. You can, you know, you can make a whole bunch of money if you raise the rents when the leases renew, at which point somebody's going to say, okay, well, if it's that easy, then why didn't you do it?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the thing, you know, if you're looking to get a higher valuation, then what you should do is you should be renewing leases at those higher rates. And if you can say, I've already renewed 35% of the leases at a higher market rate, you know, that's going to give, you know, that's going to give what you're saying a little more credence. I think similar to what you're saying is that, you know, if you're, if you have a product growth progression and you're on, say, the fourth year of your latest product, you're probably at maturity. So, but, you know, if you have a number of growth products in the pipeline coming up to that sale, you know, that will let you give you credible upside that you can get somebody to value.
You've mentioned some things that lead to more value than people understand, right? We call those, you know, risk, growth, transferability, documentation. Yeah. They call those the four pillars, but there's mortar that's holding those pillars together. And it's actually the person behind the business. So, you know, you talk about credibility, you talk about you should raise, you know, if it's so easy, why didn't you do it yourself? All of that leads to credibility and trust. Yeah. The more I believe that you've built a great business for me to take over at a great value, the more money I'm going to give you at closing. If yeah. you give me bullshit recommendations and answers and advice that just raise the hairs on the back of my neck, I'm going to negotiate harder with you. Yeah. I'm going to give you less cash. I'm not going to give you as high a value. I'm going to seek an earnout. It's all sorts of things I'm going to do because I don't fully trust you. And I yeah. might even walk away because I don't fully trust you. You know, most people have one shot, Doug, at making yeah. an investment like this. Mm-hmm. One shot. Yeah. And if they screw it up, their spouse is going to be like, nope, we're done. Yeah. Get a job. Yeah. Right? So yeah, I got to get
exactly.
it right.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. Well, walk us through a couple of the, you know, just before we're done, we conclude for the day, walk us through some of the different structures for sales. Because you were talking about, you know, the one that most people think about is, say, like a cash offer, right? You get a big chunk of cash and then you walk away and hopefully go do something useful with it. But I'm sure that that is probably, there's probably less than 10% of deals that close that way. Tell us some of the common terms you see as far as structuring deal exits.
In my world, most of them are mostly cash.
Okay.
Right. It's a wonderful and surprising thing. But the larger the transaction, the more yeah. likely that there's going to be some inclusion of a seller note, an earnout, or some other. Yeah. Sorry about that. Or
some other hitting your microphone.
Some other aspect of it. Yeah. So I mean, the first thing would be what's called a holdback. Right.
Yeah.
So if I'm buying your business, I need you to stick around for a little bit during the training yeah. and transition period. Normally it's up to 40 hours over the first 90 days. I'm going to put 10% of the purchase price in escrow.
Yeah.
And after we're done with training and transition, and I've got full control of the reins, that final 10% is released
gotcha.
To you. Then there's a seller note. You're not a bank, so mm-hmm. I cannot ask you to hold a seller note for a decade, right? But maybe 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm going to pay you on a monthly basis, and it should be an automated ACH or wire.
Yeah.
That's what you should expect as an owner. You don't want to have to go to the bank and cash check every month and look for the mail. None of that yeah. these days. An earnout is kind of an ugly feature of these larger businesses and deal structures. You know, you kind of want to avoid them if you can. It's generally, you know, you're going to get most buyers are going to look for you getting a percentage of profits up to a certain dollar value.
Yeah.
I'm very against that. I talk about it in the book. I think you ought to just go for a much smaller percentage of total revenue. It's much yeah. cleaner, much easier to calculate. And the owner of the business cannot manipulate the numbers.
I was going to say, it's, you know, less subject to cooking the books because, you know, it's very, very easy to tweak expenses, to tweak earnings because expenses are something that you can control. You have more control over revenue is more market based.
Right. And during the sale process and due diligence, you're going to get to know your buyer and you guys are going to have a good relationship. Bottom yeah. line, it's true. Absolutely true. And everything is wonderful until something goes wrong. Right. And then that, you know, they've got to feed their family and, cooking the books was never, ever an option.
So that, I wasn't actually suggesting that anybody should or would cook the books. It's my,
I know.
It's a euphemism for some of the, let's just say creative or aggressive accounting that sometimes happens in smaller businesses.
Well, when somebody ends up buying multiple brands and shares expenses, you know, after they buy your brand, they can get a little tricky.
Yeah.
They've got a bookkeeper that didn't pay as much attention, it still could hurt you. So I try to avoid the earnouts.
Like a classic example would be that, like, for example, at the end of the year, what a lot of businesses will do is they'll push a whole bunch of money into like a simple or set plan in order to reduce their taxable income. Well, yeah. So, you know, that's not what you would call cooking the books at all, but that would drastically impact how much your earnings are. And if you have an earnout that's based on that net, then you can, let's just say you can influence that a whole lot using any number of legal above the board methods.
Yes. But if you have a good attorney, that's not going to happen.
Correct.
You're going to fix the total, you know, for buyers that are savvy, they have certain ways that they have to do it based upon the lending that they've got. Yeah. And they may not be able to pay you a percentage of total revenue. They can pay you a percentage of profit, yeah, but the expenses have to be fixed at a certain percent.
Yeah. Gotcha.
That way they can't do what you just mentioned.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. Precisely.
But there's so much detail that goes into things of that nature. You know, if you're getting an earnout based upon revenue or profits, and they run out of inventory during that earnout period, it's not your fault. Yeah. They run out of inventory. So there should be a clause in there that says, yeah, you're going to get paid in full if they're out of inventory of XYZ product for any more than two, gotcha, weeks in a 3-month period. You got to hold their feet to the fire because they're the ones going to be running the business and paying you based off the revenue profit. There's so many nuances, yeah, to it that you should never, never, ever go it alone.
Yeah. Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. Well, hey, give us one last piece of wisdom, and then we'll let everybody go back to their regularly scheduled lives.
Yeah. You know, I hinted about it before, but the most important thing is not think that you're just going to get to it someday. You are, yeah, eventually going to exit your business. It's probably, if not now, eventually will be your most valuable asset. So learn everything you can, mm-hmm, about how to enhance its value and set some goals and reverse engineer a path to those goals by determining what your value is today.
Gotcha. All right. Well, hey, Joe, really appreciate your time today, and hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Doug.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Terminal Value Podcast. Share it with your friends by sending them to terminalvaluepodcast.com. For more information, please visit businessoflifellc.com for full access to Doug's products and services.
All rights reserved. No part of this broadcast may be produced in any form by any means without written permission from Business of Life LLC. All trademarks and brands referred to herein are the property of their respective owners.